right. Our final presenter in this afternoon's immunoassay session is Dr. David Tallon. Dr. Tallon is presently professor of medicine in residence at the UCLA School of Medicine. Dr. Tallon is also the chairman for the Department of Emergency Medicine at All of You, UCLA, as well as an attending physician for emergency medicine and infectious disease. Dr. Tallon received his bachelor's degree in chemistry and biology from the University of California, San Diego, and his medical degree from the University of Illinois Medical College in Chicago. Dr. Tallon has received numerous Scholastic Achievement Awards and is credited for several publications and research products. Dr. Tallon belongs to numerous professional medical societies and committees and serves both on the regional and national levels. It is my pleasure to welcome Dr. David Tallon as he presents Sepsis in the Emergency Department. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I hope you all can hear me. I know it's late in the day. It's a good idea to close those curtains because I think they look over the Pacific Ocean, which looks pretty good right now, doesn't it? Well, I don't really get a chance to talk with and meet with my colleagues in the lab very much. Now everything's automated. Used to be, I tell my residents, a long time ago we'd have to go down to the lab, call the lab on the telephone. And now all the results, you know, they're in the computer. You know, me and John McCain, we just figured that out. So, the only time I get to talk with you when there's a really big problem and somebody's calling a critical. It's like, that's it. That's the only time. We never have sort of downtime when we can't talk over some stressful situation. So maybe this is it. It's nice to have a more relaxed, chat. I'm an emergency physician and very strange. I've had a lot of different training, so I'm also an infectious diseases specialist. And my interest is at the intersection of these two things. I understand in the lab you might have some curiosity in what's going on upstairs. You know, so in the air is an exciting place. We have our own television show. You think they'll have like a microbiology lab show or a general chemistry show? Or how about blood bank? Blood bank would be, you know. Yeah, no, I don't know. And most specialties don't. You know, I don't see a dermatology show. Maybe. Maybe if there's a lot of, like, exposure, that might work. Plastic surgery, I understand. That I get. So I'll just talk with you like I would talk with clinicians to just give you some idea of what they're thinking about and some of these concepts that were referred to in the last lecture. Very good lecture. It's a little light on the lab stuff, I have to admit, but yeah, we'll bring you into the clinical world a little bit, and that'll be nice, and then we can all, that's the last lecture, right? We could all knock off for the day, you know, go to dinner. So let's talk about sepsis management. Let's see if I can get this to work, okay? This should advance the slide. Or I could go, Ginny, advance the slide, and press the button. So if you're very, very interested in this, myself, along with a bunch of other colleagues in infectious disease, critical care, but mostly all who had experience in the emergency department, put together this management guideline. This was in 2006 in the primary ER journal called the Annals of Emergency Medicine. And it was pretty up to date, fairly critical review of the literature. There's also a big sort of ongoing campaign, which I'll talk about, called the Surviving Sepsis Campaign. I don't know if anyone here is involved in the Surviving Sepsis Campaign, but I'm sure I'll manage to insult them too in just a few minutes. So as you probably heard, sepsis outcomes hadn't changed, but in the last few years, there's been a number of investigations that suggest we can do much better, reduce mortality from sepsis. And you've heard the various definitions. So just between you and me, when I say sepsis, I mean somebody really, really sick with an infection. It's been a very confused term. We've changed sort of our approach, and that's probably good for a company like BioMure is making a marker for bacterial infections that's prognostic. I have to say a lot of the enthusiasm for this move is not completely based on science. So this is, I made a little pie chart. It's about as sophisticated as I get on the PowerPoint. And so a little bit of this move has to do with science. I'm going to review the science for you. But a lot more of it is just our frustration and enthusiasm to do something. So you're going to go, oh my gosh, the surviving sepsis campaign, this huge problem that doctors are so stupid, why don't they do something different, isn't based on as much as you would think. But that's okay. We should be enthusiastic when things start to show us that there might be a possibility of helping people a lot. You know, there's guidelines that are promoting this based on sort of the preliminary science, and that sort of promotes things further. So a bunch of old guys get together in Palm Springs, have a good time, and write some guidelines, and that makes them even more important. I hope to be invited to one of those things. And then, you know, there's industries that would benefit from, you know, moving towards a different direction, and they toss in some money, and off we go to a new paradigm in sepsis management. Go ahead, Ginny, give me the next slide. So this is this insignia of the logo of the Surviving Sepsis Campaign. Below that is a friend of mine who is a researcher who actually is given credit for early goal-directed therapy, which is our primary, really, really important, we think, approach to resuscitating the hemodynamic derangement of sepsis. And then there's a quote from some cynic like me in the New England Journal that sort of points to how Lilly, that makes one of the products to treat sepsis called activated protein C, or Zygris, dumped a bunch of money and their sales went up. And so he said, well, the guidelines for the treatment of sepsis were orchestrated as an extension of a pharmaceutical marketing campaign. Give me a hit on that. And so people have said, well, there's Lilly and Edwards, and these are two companies and critical care experts, and all these hands are together and trying to push this forward. So I want you to be cynical. We have to realize that many, many important advances come through industry. In fact, most do these days. But where we are now is probably going to change, evolve, as we do more studies. And so some of this is a little bit early, you know, I have to admit. But knowing that, we still have to take care of patients. So when I go into my shift tomorrow morning and I see a septic patient, I have to make a decision. And I have to do that on the available evidence. Okay. So early goal-directed therapy. It's abbreviated EGDT. Let me give you some basics of this. This is how the handsome or beautiful ER doctor on the show would do it. In fact, this has been on ER. One of my friends writes for the show ER, and sure enough, they resuscitated a patient with early goal-directed therapy. So, you know, you got to know this. It's on TV, okay? It's a protocol based on physiologic endpoints that guide the use of a lot of the same stuff we've always done, but just we didn't know exactly how much and when and to what extent. Pressors to bring up the blood pressure, red blood cells, fluid. But the idea here is to optimize oxygen delivery to tissues, needy tissues, and very early, in the first 6 hours. So that's where the ER comes in, very important. Who gets it? People with severe sepsis or septic shock, who have a blood pressure of less than 90 or an elevated lactate. What's lactate? You heard that referred to as a marker. So if you run very fast, your thighs hurt, you start going into anaerobic metabolism. Now I know we're getting into molecules. You know this stuff better than me. I think lactate comes out. That hurts a lot. So you're oxygen starved. And lactate, if we measure it in the blood, we think is somewhat of a summative reflection of what we call global tissue hypoxia. Now, tissues are not getting enough oxygen. In its most basic form, that is what shock is. The endpoints that are used to guide these therapies are, these are the abbreviations, central venous pressure. That's sort of how much pressure is on this neck vein that when you get very angry goes up, and mean arterial pressure, that's your arterial blood pressure reading. And then this last thing is called central venous oxygen saturation. So maybe some of you have worked with blood gas lab, right? And you can measure an arterial blood gas. I'll tell you how much oxygen there is, and you can calculate on a graph or automatically what proportion of hemoglobin is saturated with oxygen. You can do that. Maybe you've seen in the ER with a little thing we put on the end of your finger. But this is actually not arterial. It's venous. And it's the venous blood that comes from an upper central intravenous line. And the idea is the better you deliver oxygen to tissues out your aorta, the tissues take some, the more is going to be, and if everything's right, the more is going to be left on the venous side. If the venous oxygen saturation is low, then there's a chance you're not delivering enough. And there's an opportunity to intervene and improve, get that to the ischemic tissues, kicking out that lactate. Okay. So this is the experiment of early goal-directed therapy. One half of the patients, they all came in, severe sepsis, septic shock. One half got standard therapy, and the other half got this protocol, which I'll go through for you. And so they start out with fluid, and they got 500 cc's of saline every half hour until the central venous pressure, so you had to put in a device to measure that, went up to certain levels. We're sort of filling the tank. And then after you reach that goal, there we go, thank you. Oh, wow. Yeah, really. You worked on the blood pressure. And if the blood pressure, the mean arterial blood pressure was low, then you gave vasopressors. And although there's been comments as to which ones are better, they allowed any of these. And then they went on. Now, then they went on to the next step. I just want to stop here and say, up to this point, there really wasn't much difference between the first two steps and standard therapy. But what really distinguishes these sort of two groups was that the next goal was to increase the central venous oxygen saturation above 70%. So if you measured it and it was lower, then there were two things you could do to increase oxygen delivery. One is increase the number of cells that carry oxygen. That would be a red blood cell transfusion. So if the patient's blood count went down, and you'll notice, we'll send a lot of serial blood counts. You're like, what's going on up there in the ER? I just measured this. And there's another one a half hour later. That's what's going on. Because as we put fluid into people, that dilutes their blood count. And if they become anemic, we transfuse them. But if that doesn't work to meet the goal, then we give an inotrope to increase cardiac output, the flow from the heart. And if that doesn't work, then if they're not already paralyzed and sedated and intubated, we do that to give them more oxygen and decrease their work of breathing and oxygen utilization. So that's it. Where they diverge is in this last goal. They increase the oxygen saturation. So that's increased oxygen delivery. Let's go to the next slide. This shows you what these people look like, a lot like the other speaker's case. It was an old person. and that's what sepsis occurs in. And they had high heart rates and low blood pressures. And down here, you see their oxygen saturations were very low. Central venous oxygen, remember, said 70. On average, they're 49. So that would imply they're not getting as much oxygen as they need. And then the lactates, go ahead, hit the button and hit it again. And the lactates are high. So we have what's called an oxygen-dependent state. Lactate indicates that the tissues are starved for oxygen, and the low central venous oxygen saturation suggests that we are not giving enough oxygen, delivering enough, so maybe we can intervene, increase oxygen delivery. How do we do that? Through this protocol and the mechanisms I talked about. Give me the next slide, please. So this is the results. It's published in the most prestigious national medical journal, the New England Journal of Medicine, and they found the most remarkable reduction in mortality that had ever really been reported in any substantial clinical trial of severe sepsis, reduction in absolute mortality from 46.5% to 30.5%. Wow, a relative reduction of about 35%, and it held up in all these groups up to 60 days, and the way it prevented death mostly was early on. It prevented sudden cardiovascular collapse. That's those code blues you hear upstairs. What's all these code blues being called? Very frustrating for a doctor. When you see somebody in sepsis, you know, you think, boy, I've got antibiotics and fluids. I know all this stuff. I should be able to get them back. Infection, we should be able to treat. But guess what? A lot of times we fail. And the worst feeling is when you get people when they're most critical at the beginning, especially in the ER or ICU, and you just watch them die in front of you. So I have a rule. Nobody will die during my shift. And if I use this, that helps me. Now, the moment I cross those double doors, baby, everything can go down the toilet. I don't care. But not while I'm there. That's my rule. I am, bam, out in the parking lot, I'm gone. But I'm going to keep you. If you or your parents come in, I am going to keep you alive. I don't care if your pulse is like this tiny. You are not going to die. And by doing this, that's sort of reassuring. Next slide. Maybe you won't. Not you. I don't mean you. You might die of boredom from this lecture. All right. Now let's look what happened. Remember, we treated these people actually in an observation area of the ER for 6 hours. So you might go, well, that's not blinded. But here's how they did it. Then they admitted them to the ICU, and the caregivers in the ICU did not know what treatment group they're in. So it was, you know, not perfect, but a relatively careful trial. And after 6 hours, they found that the group that got early goal-directed therapy, not surprisingly, had a higher central venous oxygen saturation. Well, that was the goal. And the lactates were lower, and the blood counts were a tiny bit higher, and the organ dysfunction scores were lower. So things were going in the right direction. Next slide. And now let's look at the, somebody said bundle. This, for good or bad, we don't know, is this a bunch of things together? So we can't say scientifically, well, I know it was the fluids that did it, or the pressors. But let's take a look and see what we can learn here. So these are the two groups. The early goal-directed therapy got much more fluid, almost 5 liters in the first 6 hours. But the biggest difference was the proportion of patients that got their fluid as red blood cells. You blood bank guys, pay attention. We're going to need you. So early blood transfusion, if you had to pick one, I would pick that. The pressors were the same. The inotropes were not used that much, a little bit more, though, in this group. And mechanical ventilation is the same. So next slide, or next thing. Is it all the transfusion? We don't know. There's no way to extricate one from the other because it's a big bundle. But as I tell my clinicians, like, look, if you can't figure out this whole thing, just get a type and screen down there at the blood bank. Make sure you generously fluid resuscitate and follow the serial crits and transfuse early when the patient becomes anemic. So, but that's the whole thing. And that's was the one of the main sort of motivations for the Surviving Sepsis campaign. Next. All right, so people worry about the limitations of this study because it's, do you know that the whole basis for this whole campaign is one study done in one institution? One study done in one institution. Do you think medical therapy should ever completely change because of one study in one institution? It did. Now, so people worry about putting all your EGDITs, EGDT, into one basket. I know, it's a bad joke. There's more. And that's sort of the problem. Now, there's been a lot of reports of, you know, people's changes, reduction in mortality when they compare before to after. But, you know, that's it. One study, one institution, one randomized controlled prospective study. The caregivers couldn't be completely blinded to the care because you're an ICU nurse. You're like, hey, what's this blood hanging up? I never saw blood transfusion in a septic patient, right? That might give it away. But we are measuring mortality, so maybe that's an outcome that's not that affected by biases. This thing in the box, though, is totally it's one of my themes here. When they looked at the two groups, what do you think is the most important thing for infection to treat it? How about antibiotics, right? So it would be nice if the antibiotics were given right away, and they found that in 14% of the EGDT group, the antibiotics were not given while the patient was in the emergency department, over 6 hours. But in the standard therapy group, it was given more frequently, or less likely to not be given in the ER, 7%. So you might go, well, that's really good for EGDT because that was sort of like, it was harder for them. They didn't give the antibiotics quick. On the other hand, I want you to consider the possibility that maybe early goal-directed therapy worked by sort of allowing more time for the caregivers to give the antibiotics. So just sort of hold on to that thought for a second. This imbalance is, I think, potentially very important and kind of surprising. All right, next slide. So you should know that the National Institutes of Health has funded a large multi-center validation trial. And that's wonderful. That is a great thing. But it will obviously take years. And one of the things they're actually studying are biomarkers, because you'll see as we go along that those can be really, really important. Actually, when somebody's in shock, that's pretty easy. We know what to do, but the outcomes, even at best, are still pretty terrible. What I'd like to know is just like right before,